I'm Nina Porzucchi, and you're listening to The World in Words, a podcast about languages and the people who speak them. In the 1970s, the writer Alberto Manguel was working in Milan for an Italian publisher that had taken to publishing hidden or little-known manuscripts found in secret libraries.
And one day we received a manuscript, a bulky manuscript, and when we opened it, it consisted of beautifully illustrated pages written in an incomprehensible script.
There was no note with the manuscript, no sign of who sent it or where it came from. Now, this wasn't exactly strange, says Manguel. The publisher was a bit of an unusual guy. He built the world's largest hedge maze in his backyard, according to the Guinness Book of World Records. So that day, when the strange manuscript arrived at the office, no one, according to Alberto Manguel, was wholly surprised. And yet, this manuscript, it was more than strange. It was as if the publishing house had been gifted the encyclopedia of an alien planet, with diagrams of everything on the planet, from microbes to fantastical beasts to unusual vehicles and houses, the elements of a completely unknown civilization, all described in this strange, swirly script.
We thought at first that it was in a script that we didn't know, maybe in something like Coptic or Aramean, that somebody had discovered or invented even. For quite a long time, it didn't occur to us that everything was made up, and this was a language that deliberately didn't want to make sense.
A few days went by, and still Manguel and his co-workers didn't know what to make of the manuscript.
And then a letter arrived explaining that this was the Codex Serafini.
The letter was from Luigi Serafini, an Italian architect, illustrator, and author of the Codex Serafini, which became known as the Codex Serafinianus. But who was this Luigi Serafini?
He appeared to be a very secretive man. He never came to the office. We imagined him to be an eccentric artist hidden in some little Italian village, half convinced that his illustrations depicted real things and that his script really communicated real thoughts.
The Codex Serafinianus was published in 1981, and the mysterious, illegible book got pretty decent buzz at the time. Unlike Manguel, many people did and still do believe that the Codex communicates real thoughts, and that Serafini holds the cipher. But as mysteriously as the book appeared, after a few years it just slipped into obscurity and into the dusty archives of university libraries. Serafini himself has remained relatively silent about the book. I tried to get in touch with him, no luck. He just doesn't want to talk about it. And even on the rare occasions when he has talked about the book, his words on the genesis of his work are like almost as cryptic as the text itself.
Allora, dunque, c'era una volta. Dunque,
the way it started was casual, he says in Italian at a rare 2014 press conference. It's a lot like the story of creation, as if the artist was possessed by something, by the zeitgeist, by the spirit of the times, by something shaped by forces we don't even know about, like aliens. I'm still quoting Serafini here. There's more. Today, actually, I took a taxi from the train station, and the cab driver said, for sure, aliens are among us, looking for diamonds. So every day, something happens that could be part of the Codex, like this cab driver who said aliens are here to look for diamonds. Okay, cab drivers, aliens, diamonds. What does this mean? And does a cipher exist to break Serafini's cryptic code? Cain Foucher is an unofficial codex expert. Cain?
Yes, hi, Nina.
Hi, how are ya?
Oh, not bad.
He's been obsessed with the book ever since he first discovered it in a university library basement when he was an undergraduate at Carleton University in Canada more than a decade ago.
I'll confess I wanted to steal it. But I, of course, did not.
Eventually, he bought his own copy. But Cain's impulse, it's eerily familiar. There's just something about the Codex that makes you want to hold it and hoard it for yourself. It's really hard to explain. Almost as if you kept it close and you just kept thumbing through the pages, you'd suddenly find a clue to what this alternate world meant.
So first you look at it, or at least in my experience, I looked at it, I see these images, and your eyes are completely drawn to these strange, weird images, like, you know, like a rainbow flying machine, or all the organisms that live in a stream of light, you know, the tiny organisms, or two humans that are having sex that turn into crocodiles. Crazy pictures. But then, for me, what pulled me in is this volume of text, because it's a serious book and it's super heavy, it's really fat, and it's full of, can you call them words? I don't know. Like,
yeah, that's the thing too, is that, you know, you really can't call them words, and there's a kind of logocentric bias we all have. We're trying to find some sort of, you know, what's the signifier here? Like, what is this? This must be saying something. You got diagrams here. It's quite elaborate. You've got tables. There's a language section where it seems to show all the sort of the glyphs, all the letters. And you're thinking to yourself, there must be some sort of meaning behind this.
And so you actually, though, tried to crack the code.
Oh, yeah. I wasted, I'm embarrassed to say how many weeks or months worth of attempts.
So what did you do?
Oh, geez. I drew up tables and matrices and things like that. I tried to have a one-to-one correspondence between one of these mysterious glyphs and, you know, letters of the alphabet. I compared against different languages. So I thought, well, what languages would Luigi Serafini know? And so I reasoned that he, of course, would know Italian. Probably French and some English as well. So I also used Latin. So I tried all these different attempts.
Wow. And what happened?
Nothing. There is no actual language behind this artificial simulacrum of language.
Nothing. That is not what I wanted to hear. I mean, really, could this entire tome, I mean, it must weigh, I don't know, a good 5 pounds. Could all of this script, all these images just be nothing?
Really, it's what's called Greeking the text. It's just a makeup language that really has
no rhyme or reason or no structure.
Oh, yeah. And it's funny because if you were to do that, you were to take, you know, say, I'm going to make a bunch of squiggles and I'm going to pretend it's language. After a while, your brain likes to impose patterns on things. So eventually some of those squiggles are going to start reoccurring. And then there's going to be a certain sense of reason and repetition. So I think that's what he did. I tried to do the same thing, and now I can do it too. I can actually write in Serafinian.
Really?
I don't know what I'm saying. I can compose the letters. Give me a sheet of paper, and I can just sort of compose the letters. I actually created my own sort of codex pages, used some illustrations, and just put Serafinian text around them and tried to make sort of lost pages of the codex. And then I also created a font for the computer, so if ever I want to sort of just type it, I can.
Yes, he has his own fake codec pages. They're pretty good. Cain actually was almost relieved that the codex turned out to be meaningless.
Would I want to have cracked it if there was a code? You know, the real answer to that is no. Because one of the worst possible fates that could happen to this book is if it did have a meaning behind the text, then it could turn out to be banal. It could be disappointing, right? It could be sort of like, and this is a hippopotamus with springs in it. And then you're like, okay, this is kind of dull.
Right. It would take the air out of it in some ways. Like, what is so wonderful about the book is that you don't understand it at all.
Oh, exactly.
That's just it. The sheer incomprehensibleness, if that's a word, of the Codex Serafinianus is its meaning. The real secret of the Codex, according to Cain, is not what the text may or may not mean, but actually the feeling that it evokes while we're trying to make that meaning. It's a feeling that we've all felt before, says Kane. We just may not remember.
Think back to when you were two or three before you were able to read books and you pulled an encyclopedia off the shelf. I mean, what would you make? You couldn't read any of the text. Words wouldn't make sense, but you'd recognize some of the sort of pictures that would be in there, kind of.
And it was a helicopter. And it was...
Because you haven't had all that sort of world experience yet, you can recognize a hippopotamus, a giraffe, and so forth, but you don't recognize everything. So it's trying to emulate how children actually come to books before they're able to read them.
And this was, where's this? That.
Bulldozer?
This is my friend Adi Rubin and her three-year-old son Matan reading.
And it was a puzzle at the front, and it was an earth rock.
That's it, the secret of the codex. It reminds us of the very basis of what it is to be human, our compulsion to make meaning even when there is no meaning to be found. Alberto Manguel, remember the guy we met at the beginning of the story who discovered the manuscript on the steps of the publisher's door? He agrees with Kane.
We have a tendency to believe that everything that surrounds us is an encoded language, that landscape wants to tell us something, that the stars constellate into images and text, that the world itself is a book open for us to read. We make sense of the world in order to survive in it, even if the world doesn't make sense.
We tell stories in order to live. So goes the often quoted opening line of Joan Didion's The White Album. It's overused for sure, but I just love that quote. And I love it so much that this is embarrassing to admit, I even put it at the top of my resume. It's a great line. But I wanted to end with a line further along in that first paragraph of the Didion essay. Quote, "We look for the sermon in the suicide, for the social or moral lesson in the murder of five. We interpret what we see, select the most workable of the multiple choices." And here I am, trying to make meaning, select the most workable choice, where really there is no meaning at all. One last thing. Luigi Serafini did write what he calls the, quote, decodex for the latest edition of the book, released a few years ago. This was huge! And in the decodex, he attributes the entire tome to a little white cat that apparently sat on his shoulders while he worked on the book. So he was just channeling a cat.
Cats are mysterious inspirations. When writers are asked why they wrote something, how they wrote something, they don't really know, but they make things up.
Drugs might also help. Serafini did admit in a 2013 interview in the Italian edition of Wired magazine that he may have done a little mescaline while he was working on the book. Yeah, there we go again, telling ourselves stories. Well, that's all for this week. If you're curious to see some pages of the codex, be sure to check out the show notes for this episode on pri.org/language. And if you want to hear some stories live, yes, live, and you happen to be in New York City this June 21st, Tuesday, The World in Words will be spinning yarns at the New York Public Library, the one with the lions. And the topic of the evening is endangered languages, from Ainu to Zaza. Go to pri.org/language for a link to tickets. Tweet us at LingoPod. I'm at Porzuki, that's P-O-R-Z-U-C-K-I. And as always, thanks so much for listening.
I always say it wrong because it's got a so Codex Serafinianus.
Potato, potato, really.